Lecture 5, The Formation of the Kingdoms.
When Alexander died in Babylon in 323 BC, there also died with him the dream of a united empire of Greeks and Persians. We've already seen that Alexander had been trying to reconcile two systems that fundamentally could not be reconciled. On the one hand, there was a Persian system which was hierarchically organized and required at its apex a king ordained by heaven, a great king to whom you prostrated yourself. And on the other hand, there was a Macedonian system in which the king was the leader of a band of essentially equal nobles. Alexander's officers were utterly uninterested in trying to continue the experiment in fusion that he had initiated. And I've suggested that Alexander's failure was probably not due to any irreparable difference between the cultures, but quite simply to the fact that he died after campaigning for 11 years, but before being allowed to rule that empire for any length of time. And I compared him, for example, to Augustus, who effected a transformation in the Roman world largely because he continued to rule for 40 years. But instead of there being a united Greco-Persian monarchy or ruling elite running the empire, instead the generation after Alexander's death saw the entire Eastern Mediterranean and much of the Near East plunged into a paralyzingly difficult to follow round of civil wars, wars fought by one Macedonian general against another, extending for 30 years and embracing all of the region that Alexander had just conquered and annexed for the Macedonians. It is, in fact, the most depressing coda to the brilliant career of Alexander that one can imagine. As his generals clustered around his dead body in Babylon and carved up his empire like jackals around a carcass. And so what I want to look at today is the issue of how that round of warfare worked itself out and what kind of political order emerged from that, since it was clearly not going to be anything like the earlier Macedonian kingship or the dream that Alexander had had for his empire. First of all, I think we need to understand why it is that his officers resisted so strongly the kind of dream, the kind of vision of the future that Alexander had offered by trying to merge Greeks and Persians. Why were they so resistant to the notion of power sharing or of creating a new elite? The reason, I think, is that his generals were not merely subjects. They called themselves his philoi, in other words, his friends. They regarded themselves as being, in many ways, his equals, even though, of course, they had not led the campaign that he had. But you must remember that many of the generals and the leading soldiers in that army were men, in fact, of Philip II's generation, men who were 20 or 30 years older than Alexander. And these men were uninterested in the idea of sharing power with the Persians. Among the nobility in Macedon, there existed a strongly egalitarian ideology. The king was king not by divine right, but because of his preeminence. That is why Alexander had always had to be the first man over the wall, the first man into the breach, the first man on the attack. Because he was the first among peers. And just as the king ate and drank among his peers, we've seen many of the stories already of Alexander drinking with his other generals, so too they fought as equals. And this notion of equality is evoked even by the names of the battalions within the Macedonian army, so that the elite cavalry is called the companion cavalry. Companions of the king, companions of each other, equals in the game of war. And the elite battalion in the infantry was known technically as the pedzatyroi, which means the foot companions. Again, men who proclaimed that they could stand shoulder to shoulder in battle with the Macedonian king. For these men who proved their valor by defeating the great king and his armies, Persia was not a noble adversary to be treated as an equal, but rather a conquered empire. It was booty to be carved up the way a carcass is carved up after it has been hunted down and slaughtered. Alexander was the glue that kept the Macedonian world together. This entire enterprise of taking Macedonian power out way beyond anywhere the Greeks had ever gone before. It was he, who was at the very center of all this. And with his death, the Macedonians were confronted by a paralyzing void. In fact, you could go so far as to say that just about every bad condition or circumstance imaginable conspired to occur upon the death of Alexander. Consider these factors, for example. When Alexander died, his queen, his wife Roxanne, was pregnant. Now, the complication here is obvious. It is not clear, for a start, that she is going to bring the child to term and that a child will be born. It could be stillborn or it could die in the womb. If she does bear a child, there is no guarantee that it's going to be a boy who will have a claim to the throne. It could have been a girl. No one could predict at Alexander's death whether the pregnant Roxanne would have a girl, and the Macedonians had never put a queen on the throne, so that was left in doubt. And quite frankly, even if at some future point she were to give birth to a boy, there is no way that he would be in a position to assert his authority, and that's what makes a Macedonian king a king, not his blood, but his authority. He wouldn't be able to assert it for at least another 16 years. So Alexander's death had left the Macedonians in limbo without any clear indication of who was going to be the next king and who would have legitimate authority. And quite frankly, even if the child were born and grew up and eventually were to be recognized as a stout commander and a good general, he wouldn't even be a purely born Macedonian or even Greco-Macedonian, because his mother, Roxanne, was from Bactria, out in the upper eastern satrapies of the former Persian Empire. Who knows? In 20 years' time, the Macedonians might be saying, we don't want a posthumous bastard ruling over us if he's not even Macedonian and Greek. So that was massively complicated, and it really paralyzed the negotiations upon Alexander's death. There was a second great complication. During all the negotiations between the Macedonian generals, the jockeying for power that took place after Alexander's death, the common belief, the assumption that every general made was that it was they, the Macedonian elite, the generals of Alexander's army, who would have the final say. So that we hear of negotiations involving Perdiccas, Ptolemy I, Lysimachus, Seleucus, these great men who had led the Macedonians in battle. And they bargained with each other and negotiated with each other, and they completely ignored one other important factor in the negotiations. That is, that the Macedonian king was to be acclaimed by the Macedonian state. And the Macedonian state here in Babylon was the army, not the generals and the officers, the ordinary men who'd fought for Alexander. Now, these men not only were committed to Alexander, but they were committed to the bloodline of his family. They wanted someone related to Alexander to be on the throne. And they had a candidate, and they put him forward. The candidate's name was Aridaeus. He was the older half-brother of Alexander. And according to all accounts, it's hard to test this, but according to all accounts, there was something wrong with him. He may have been mentally defective. He may have some debilitating disease, some dreadful form of epilepsy. We don't really know what it was. Of course, there were stories in antiquity that Olympias had poisoned him when he was a child to clear the way to the throne for her son Alexander, but we don't know. What we can say is this. Alexander had carefully ensured that no competitor to the throne who had royal blood stayed alive when he himself, Alexander, became king. And the fact that Philip Aridaeus, now as king was called Philip, the fact that Philip Aridaeus was still alive must suggest that he was regarded by the rest of the Macedonian nobility as physically incapable of serving as king. Now, exactly what the nature of the disability was, we don't know. But while all the negotiations were going on between Perdiccas and Ptolemy and Seleucus and the rest of these generals, there in the tent, right next to them, was Aridaeus, who they'd ignored and overlooked. And it was he who the Macedonian soldiers said, "We want as king." the army threatened to go into revolt and to rebel completely from the entire officer corps. And all of these high-ranking generals were forced simply to accept the fact that Alexander the Great was now going to be succeeded by an unborn fetus and a half-wit older half-brother. That's what the Macedonian Empire was put into the hands of. Now, the period that follows Alexander's death and the elevation of Philip Aridaeus and finally then the birth of Alexander's son, who would be called Alexander the Fourth, the period after this, from 323 down to the end of the century, virtually the last quarter of the 4th century BC, is essentially a period during which the various great generals of Alexander's army jockeyed for position in relation to each other, forming alliances, fighting against common enemies in an attempt to secure their own power, and in two cases, in an attempt to re-establish the unity of Alexander's empire. So what I want to look at now is the record of these campaigns, despite the fact that the detail is often difficult to follow, because I want to chart the course by which the two men who had a chance of unifying Alexander's empire failed, and how out of the void of that failure was created a new political order, namely the political order of the Hellenistic Age. The first of the men to try to unify the empire of Alexander was Perdiccas. Perdiccas had served as his vizier, as his prime minister, if you like, after the death of Alexander's close friend Hephaestion, and he was the natural person to take over the reins of power. While negotiations were going on at Babylon, it was Perdiccas who had made sure that in the tent where the generals did their trading, Alexander's ring and scepter were there on a throne, looming over all of these negotiations. And at Babylon, in the first round of negotiations between the Hellenistic generals, he found himself in a very powerful position because he had command of Alexander's army and he possessed the two new kings in his entourage. It was he who took over as guardian for Philip Aridaeus and for the now infant child Alexander the Fourth. So he had a shot. He had a real shot at keeping Alexander's dream alive, of keeping the empire in the control of this family, with himself as the power behind the throne, or perhaps, who knows, even asserting himself as the new king of Alexander's empire. But Perdiccas's power evaporated almost immediately, because in the very first year, after the generals had divided up Alexander's empire, as each of them went off to their various provinces, their satrapies as they were called, to take over, Perdiccas made the decision to attack Egypt. Now, Egypt was the province that had been taken over by Ptolemy. Ptolemy, one of Alexander's bodyguards, one of his generals, now one of his most successful followers, had himself appointed as satrap of Egypt. Satrap, provincial governor. In effect, he was truly the independent ruler. He continued to put up monuments and to issue decrees in the name of Philip Aridaeus and Alexander the Fourth, the Macedonian kings, but the true power was certainly in Ptolemy's hands. And Egypt had been a cunning choice because it was an area that was virtually self-contained. It was hard to attack from the east because of desert, hard to attack from the west because of desert, hard to attack from the north because of the delta, and hard to attack from the south because of the river and because of the cataracts of the Nile. So he'd cut off a hunk of Alexander's empire that he could hang on to on his own. But Perdiccas wanted to dislodge him. Why? Perdiccas, surely with the Macedonian kings in tow, was heading back to Macedon, and he couldn't afford to leave this powerful, independent ruler behind him ready to attack. And so he headed towards Egypt. But just as he was on the point of crossing over the Nile, his army went into revolt against him, and Perdiccas was cut down by his own men. Almost certainly, the men who cut him down had been bribed by Ptolemy. So the round of warfare between these Macedonian generals had moved into its next phase. With Perdiccas dead, with the one man who had control of the army and control of the kings dead, the various generals of Alexander's army met again, this time in Syria at a site called Triparadesos. And we have an account of the meeting between these various generals. I'll read you a short segment of it because I think it gives a very graphic illustration of the mindset of these men and how they were treating Alexander's domains. Antipater, who was the regent of Macedon, in his turn carried out a distribution of provinces. So he's divvying up the empire, partly confirming the previous arrangements of Babylon in 323 and partly modifying them. Now listen to just some of the names. These names are going to run throughout the rest of this course. These are going to be the founders of the great dynasties of the Hellenistic world. They begin here as Alexander's generals being awarded satrapies or provinces which will mutate into kingdoms. Ptolemy was to control Egypt, Libya, and all the expansive territory beyond it. Syria was entrusted to Laomedon. Philoxenos he appointed to Cilicia. Of the upper satrapies, he assigned Mesopotamia to Amphimachus. To Seleucus, he gave Babylon. That's going to be an important name. And then here's an interesting detail. Antigenes, who had been the first to attack Perdiccas and who commanded the Macedonian silver shields, was granted the rule over the whole of Susiana. What's happening here is that these men have quite literally sat down with a map of the old Persian Empire. These maps existed specifying particular satrapies, and they have simply traded with each other saying, okay, you get Egypt, you get Babylon, you get Susa. Jackals round a carcass. According to this arrangement at Triparadesos in 321, the two kings, Philip Aridaeus and Alexander IV, were escorted home back to Macedon by Antipater, who remained regent. Ptolemy kept control, as we saw, of Egypt, Seleucus getting Babylon. But the most important character, the most powerful man to emerge in this round of warfare between the various forces, was a man by the name of Antigonus, who was made satrap of Asia. Now, Antigonus is one of the most romantic figures in the Hellenistic period. He was from Philip's generation, older than Alexander. So while Alexander dies as a young man around 30, Antigonus, we have to imagine here, is a man of about 50 or 60. And he continued to campaign for the next 10 years or so, even though he'd lost one eye and was known as Antigonus the One-Eyed. A tremendously vigorous campaigner. Between 320 and 311 BC, after Triparadesos and for the next decade, Antigonus's power was so great that he was immediately opposed by an alliance of the other Hellenistic kings. Ptolemy in Egypt, Seleucus in Babylon, Lysimachus in Thrace, and Cassander, who had taken over in Macedon after the death of his father Antipater. These men would reach a peace settlement in 311 BC, and the terms of the settlement reflect the status quo which had emerged over the course of that last decade, a decade that had been marked by virtually continuous warfare. And this status quo of great power blocks competing with each other, always aligning whenever one ruler became more powerful than the others, was to be really the legacy of Alexander's successors. Intermittent, yet virtually continuous warfare between great dynastic and regional blocks. The issue of ruling an empire in the early Hellenistic age was always going to be subordinated to the more pressing issue of acquiring or securing the empire. External warfare, foreign policy, dealing with the other successors of Alexander, successors, not successors, dealing with these other successors, these other generals, these would be the driving concerns of a generation of Macedonian generals. So that for them, the question of the internal organization of their kingdoms, for example, the relationship between ruler and ruled, would be worked out in a completely haphazard fashion. They had no plan for rule at all, because they were always more concerned with the others. For the first generation, at least, the new rulers of the Hellenistic world were uninterested in any questions of Greek culture and its fusion with non-Greek culture because they were too busy trying to kill each other. By 310 BC, the political landscape of Alexander's empire had assumed the shape that it would keep throughout the rest of the Hellenistic era. That is to say, major kingdoms were emerging, though the title was not yet used. The Ptolemies controlled Egypt. The Seleucids held Syria and Babylon. Macedon remained a separate region which would be ruled first by Antipater's son Cassander and later would be controlled by another dynasty, while the Antigonids controlled most of Asia Minor. So these four or five major power blocks will be the essential political shape of the early Hellenistic period. Even so, the rulers here, these great men, were still ruling nominally as governors of territory conquered by Alexander. The decisive step in the final transformation of these territories into kingdoms came in 310 BC, because it was in that year that the last blood of Alexander finally died. His son, Alexander IV, was killed. And that event cleared the way for these generals to assert their independent authority as kings. We have a description of this in Diodorus, and clearly we see, if you consider the dates, 310, Alexander had died in 323, his child is now about 13 years of age, he's getting close to the age, in about 3 years he'll be 16, the same age Alexander was when he fought on the left wing at Chaeronea. This child is just at the point of entering adolescence and becoming a man. And that's a problem, because now we'll have a real and viable successor to Alexander. So here are the circumstances. In that peace treaty of the various Hellenistic rulers in 311, Cassander, Ptolemy and Lysimachus put an end to the war against Antigonus and they concluded a treaty. It was specified in it that Cassander should be general of Europe until Alexander, Roxanne's son, would come of age, and Lysimachus should be master of Thrace, Ptolemy master of Egypt and the neighbouring cities of Libya and Arabia. Antigonus would have command of Asia while the Greeks would be autonomous. So this is the usual Hellenistic division of power that we've already seen on at least two earlier occasions. Nevertheless, they failed to abide by this agreement, says Diodorus, and each of them put forward fair pretexts and sought to increase their power. And now we get to the important clause. Cassander, Antipater's son, saw that Alexander IV, the son of Roxanne and Alexander the Great, was growing up. And there were some who were spreading the word in Macedon that one ought to release the boy from custody and hand over to him his father's kingdom. So the critical moment has come. That posthumous heir is now ready to become king. Afraid for his own safety, Cassander instructed Glaucias, who was in charge of the boy's custody, to assassinate Roxanne and the king and to conceal their bodies, though eventually news did creep out of what had happened. Philip Aridaeus, the older imbecile, had been killed in another round of these wars some 7 years earlier, so that from 310 BC there was now no longer anyone of the blood of Alexander to sit on the throne of Macedon. So we're facing a void. There is no king of Macedon of that blood when it is that kingship which has defined all of these emerging territories. The final stage really will come almost as an anticlimax only 4 years later. And I must read you the description of this because the anticlimax is itself quite amusing. This is how Ptolemy, Seleucus and the other generals became kings. Listen to this. It's from Plutarch's life of one of these generals named Demetrius. The multitude then for the first time proclaimed Antigonus and Demetrius kings. They had just won a battle off the coast of Cyprus against the navy of Ptolemy. Antigonus' friends tied at once a diadem around his head, while Demetrius was sent a diadem by his father and addressed as king in a letter he wrote. When the news was reported, now listen to this, this is really astonishing. When the news was reported, Ptolemy's followers in Egypt also proclaimed Ptolemy king to dispel any impression that his defeat had humbled his pride. There, there, Ptolemy, don't feel badly. Oh, by the way, now you're a king. This is how he's acclaimed. And so emulation spread the practice like a contagion among the successors. Lysimachus began to wear the diadem, Seleucus began to style himself as king, and Cassander wrote to the others and said they should address him as king as well. So it's a slightly pathetic expression, if you will, of what's happened at the end of the 4th century. Because of a naval victory, two guys call themselves king and the rest of the people follow suit so that nobody will be too depressed. Perhaps they had issues of self-esteem. Kings. Kings of what? They're not kings of Macedon. Ptolemy's not in Macedon. Seleucus is in Babylon. So what are they kings of? The answer finally doesn't matter. The idea that you were a king of a specific kingdom no longer even made any sense to the Greeks of this period. Instead, this notion of kingship was not associated with a territory, but only with the personality of a man. He was king because of his accomplishments. Ptolemy's men said they didn't want him to be disheartened because of the defeat of victory, so they too acclaimed him king. Not because he had control of Egypt, simply because of himself. So the origins of this kingship don't lie in the control of a particular territory, but rather in the acclamation of a king by his people. So there were no constitutional guidelines for the formation of these Hellenistic kingdoms. They'd emerged piecemeal from the wars between Alexander's successors. And the only qualification that one needed to be a king in this new age was charismatic leadership, success in battle, being able to rally your troops. And it is this new notion of kingship which comes to attract the attention of the philosophers and the writers of the Hellenistic age. They become fascinated about the question of what makes a king a king. So, for example, one definition of the Hellenistic age reads, of monarchy in the Hellenistic age reads as follows. It is neither descent nor legitimacy which gives monarchies to men, but the ability to command an army and to handle affairs competently. Such was the case with Philip and the successors of Alexander. For Alexander's natural son was in no way helped by his kinship with him because of his weakness of spirit, while those who had no connection with Alexander became kings of almost the whole inhabited world. So we've established here the notion that these kings are not kings because they're descended from royal families. They're not. They're bodyguards and generals. Nor even by legitimacy, or as in fact it says really in the Greek, justice. It's not even that they have some right to be king. It's certainly not a question of divine right. They have the right to be king simply because they are competent, they are able to supply their men to command an army and to handle affairs. The justification for this kingship lies in the expression itself of being a great king. Now, other thinkers also were fascinated by this question of where kingship comes from and what makes a king a king. And in one extraordinary document recorded in Diodorus, it becomes clear that some people were playing with the idea that kings and gods were really two sides of the same coin. Let me read you from the doctrines of Euhemerus, who says that Uranus, Uranos to the Greeks, was the first king, an honourable man, beneficent and versed in the movement of the stars, and who was the first to honour the heavenly gods with sacrifices. That's why he was called Uranus. But his wife Hestia had two sons. They reigned in a place off somewhere in the perimeter of the Greek world, Pankaia, a kind of fantasy land. And after his death, he then becomes a god. He's taken up into heaven. So the Hellenistic age begins with a very fascinating conception of kingship. In a void created by Alexander's death, first we have them playing with the idea of the succession by blood of Alexander. But that doesn't work because we have a child who is a threat to them and a half-wit. And so then we begin playing with the idea of kingship based on valor. And that is why these men must fight these wars for a generation against each other until they finally establish their Hellenistic kingdoms. What then emerges is the political pattern that is going to dominate the next 300 years, from essentially the death of Alexander until the Roman conquest of the Hellenistic world. And during that 300 years, as we're going to see in the coming lectures, we will have one kingdom in Egypt controlled by the Ptolemies, another in Syria controlled by Seleucus, and yet another in Macedon. And it is going to be these great dynastic regional kingdoms born out of the void created by Alexander's death that will be the major dynastic blocks of the Hellenistic world. And it will be they who rule independently until finally, by 31 BC, we find the Romans establishing their authority in the Hellenistic world.